This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
I'm Wang Xiaoning, and this is The Breakfast Grill. Are your accounts in order? Have you filed your taxes properly? Not sure about whether you have the right strategy to grow your business? Questions most companies would have asked themselves, but perhaps need answers for. So today we speak to PwC Malaysia, who tries to provide all these solutions. Suhu Kunyan, their managing partner, joins us. I want to start off with the numbers. The last 12 months ending 30th June last year, PwC firms around the world had gross revenues of $45 billion. So it's a 5% improvement. An achievement considering that we're supposed to be in a global recession because of the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, what's business been like for PwC Malaysia though?
We are somewhat impacted one way or another. But having said that, the initial concerns were never really materialized. The concerns were drop in demand over the work never really happened. On the contrary, there is more work as clients are also trying to find new solutions. So if I were to sum up three main impacts that the firm has been impacted on, is that number one, the obvious one is the war for talent has really, really intensified. The great resignation does have an impact to the profession and to a certain extent, a firm like ours as well. Uncharted territories means also need to constantly innovate and be ahead of the curve to answer questions that never been asked before. And lastly, of course, the work processes have changed.
Okay, I want to focus on this point you just brought up, which is questions being asked of you that have never been asked before. What do you mean by this?
There are a lot of advisory work coming out from strategy directions because the old playbook doesn't work anymore. Many, more often than not, you find that even successful organizations, you'll find that what works in the past may not necessarily so in the future. So there are many questions unanswered. They have also sought the view of third parties like ourselves to look at what other people are doing, what's going on around the world, to see what can be adapted and help them address their strategies.
Over time, what has happened in a typical accounting firm is that there are three broad segments, right? You've got assurance, which is the audit consulting advisory, which includes digital services, risk assurance, and of course, what we fear most, tax and legal. But I want to rewind, Suhu, to 20 years ago, and remember the Enron scandal that resulted in actually the Big Five becoming the Big Four. Is history repeating itself? Because after the Enron scandal, EY, KPMG, and even yourselves, PwC, they sold off their consultancy business or advisory services. And now it seems like this is the new area of growth.
Okay. So maybe I'll just rewind a little bit back on the evolution of the business. Many years back, people come to us as a one-stop center to cover everything from audit to tax to consulting-related work. But it is still on one single client. But those days have got long gone. But even then also, I think at one stage, you have firms like ourselves selling off the consulting practice. But the market actually have changed a lot. Today, we are not talking about just a set of clients for us. We do audit for audit clients. But a lot of advisory-related work are performed on non-audit clients. So in short, you find that professional services firm no longer have only one single portfolio of clients, but generally you find that they have two or three portfolio of clients.
But is there ever a situation where PwC plays the dual role of the auditor and the and consultant for a client?
Well, generally we are bound by our global requirements to minimize conflict of interest. We have very clear policies and requirements on what we can work for an audit client. So we actually follow those rules very strictly. So even anywhere in the world, if there is for example, a Malaysian client and they have sought the service, non-audit services of from an overseas firm like ours, and the overseas network firm actually need to seek the approval from the relevant audit partner before they can actually commence the work. The rules are very, very strict and actually is quite clear-cut. Generally, you find that most of the non-audit work that we perform for audit clients are related to assurance-related work. For example, reporting accountants, for example, some agreed-upon procedures. That is mainly audit in nature rather than transformational or management-related kind of work-life strategy. A good example, an IT transformation work or technology implementation work definitely would not have been allowed for a typical audit client.
Okay, so you don't have to play arbitrator within, let's say, PwC Malaysia.
There are clear guidelines for everyone to follow. So everyone sign up to those guidelines. So it's quite fairly straightforward generally. Of course, there are areas that sometimes can be a little bit grey.
Yeah.
But the power to decide actually rests with the audit partner because it is for him to decide or her to decide whether this will result in an independence issue from an audit standpoint.
That's interesting to know because I understand it's actually the consulting or advisory margins which are always better than the audit margins. So I would assume that...
So.
Oh, that's not so? Okay.
We wouldn't recommend more than this, but definitely not necessarily so.
Okay, because I thought then, you know, the consulting partner would have a greater say and there would be a desire to grow revenues in that.
Not really. I think those days have long gone past. I think it's no longer relevant in today's professional service world.
I do want to bring the conversation back to the present, and I think we won't name names, and neither will I ask you to disclose any client privilege information. But I think you know, and I know, that there have been a few headlines in the papers where companies clash with their auditors after their discrepancies. Can you walk us through this process? Help us understand, what is the internal process before, let's say, these warning bells are sound and it becomes public information that the auditor has issues about the accounts?
If I were to look at internal process, I mean, I'm not in the liberty to share in detail on how we look at such things. But generally, you find that for auditors, especially for the larger firms, tend to have internal consulting process to make sure that the partner doesn't make the call on an individual basis. It must be a collective call because it will represent the firm's views. But more importantly is that what we normally find, I personally, being an audit partner for many years, in most difficult situations, and I repeat again, in most instances, when it comes to a difficult situation or a difficult call, the recommendation made by the auditors normally tend to also is in the interest of the board. I think the onus must be for the auditors to be able to articulate that point of view clearly, confidently, more importantly, put it from the perspective of the relevant stakeholders, rather than just from the auditor's perspective.
Okay. You know, the reason why I ask this question is sometimes people argue that auditors take a long time to come up with their findings, and by the time they reveal it, it's too late. Could they work a bit faster? Could they tell the public a little bit earlier? Could these warning bells be sound sooner rather than later? Especially, you know, in recent times, a lot of the clients are actually governments.
Oh, yes, of course. I think generally is that, for a start, is that sometimes I also see that there is some level of expectation gap between the market or society at large with what the auditors do. Because if you look at the scope of financial audit, while it seems wide, and yet it is in a way restrained by a set of auditing standards, and it has never been designed to detect fraud, for example. But many instances you find is that the market, societies, and politicians, not in Malaysia, as you see in the UK, tend to look at auditors as hound dogs. And that is where I find there is a discrepancy in expectation and hence caused some of the uproar, what you see in the press.
So what is the role of the auditor then, if it's not to actually be almost like a private investigator of the accounts and warn us of anything?
Level, like for example, you look at financial audit or statutory audit, is to give certain level of assurance that the financial statement is true and fair. Right? But if you were to read the concept of true and fair, it is not to give you a full assurance or in a way a full insurance or that the numbers are all exactly accurate.
I mean, some people say they pay you fees. Isn't that what your role is for?
Oh, obviously, the fees will commensurate with the level of work needs to be done. In this case, most of the work is done on a sample basis. But if you were to extend to 100% test of all the transactions in the organization or the client space, then the cost will be quite unwieldy.
Has COVID-19 made your roles and responsibilities even more challenging, even in the audit world? Because, or I know you're saying you're not the hound dog, but even spotting fraud, for example, because with COVID-19, on-site checks are probably challenging. And I would assume it's sometimes the casual chats at the client sites with a random employee that leads to a finding, and maybe that there is that missed opportunity now.
Oh, thanks. A very good question indeed. I think I would say that it's yes and no. Yes and no, in the sense that, yes, it does have an impact because for a few reasons. One is, like you rightly pointed out, that there is relatively lower physical engagement between the auditee and the auditor. So the tendency to look at, for example, body language tend to be reduced. But having said that, but because the saving grace is the technology, with technology, you can actually download data on a virtual basis and to be able to spot certain trends or unusual trends that you can post further question and clarification. So that actually helped a lot in terms of addressing the concern.
What about the fact that fraud has become, or companies actually have become more and more sophisticated? They operate over multiple jurisdictions, sometimes they have multiple businesses. So, for example, recently, Heng Leong in Singapore, right? They're the famous oil trader. They use this teaming and lading system to get around the rules. How does a firm like PwC keep up with all these new ways of defrauding the public?
Yeah, so again, it's a very pertinent question for the auditing profession, right? I think one thing that we need to be very clear is that fraud and fraudulent intention is, it transcends across different generations. It has always been there. The biggest difference in my mind between now and then is that now the fraudster, for example, or the people who have the intention to create fraud have technology at their fingertips, which means new type of risk will evolve and new ways of creating fraud will happen via technology. Cybersecurity is being, cyber is being one of them, hacking, and you deploying technology to minimize transaction trail, for example, will also be possible. So the biggest challenge for auditing firms generally is that you must be able to keep up with the trend, meaning that you must deploy the relevant audit techniques by also deploying technology. You must be able to use, like, for example, data analytics tools to look at unusual trends to be able to at least having a higher chance of spotting some of these unusual items and transactions. And this also means that we have to upskill our people. Our biggest challenge today is that if you look at college education for accountants are still a little bit behind, simply because it has not been designed to deal with this, what I call the cutting-edge stuff. As a result, what you find is that most professional firms will have invested a lot more now to get people up to speed.
On the Breakfast Grill this morning is Suhu Kun Yen, Managing Partner of PwC Malaysia. When we come back, human capital and has the great resignation affected them? BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. In the hot seat this morning is Suhu Kun Yen, the Managing Partner at PwC Malaysia. Just before the break, we were talking about whether there's any conflict of interest within their inherent business model. But Suhun, let's talk about growth and competition. We know that other accounting firms give you a run for the money, be it EY, Deloitte, KPMG. But is the real competition actually the smaller firms like BDO or Baker Tilly?
Well, I think I would argue that as far as the profession is concerned, competition is fairly healthy. At most of the firms, whether you are medium-sized or the smaller firms or the very large one, you have your own niche to play in. There may be overlap, but certainly there is sufficient space for everyone to be able to play a niche and create their own competitive edge in a specific part of the market.
So what is your niche? What is PwC's specialty then?
Well, PwC, if you were to look at our own client portfolio as a whole and the market segment, we tend to service the larger organizations in the country and also state governments and federal in the public space.
And let's talk about advisory services also there. Isn't it very competitive? And aren't you competing in the same space as some of the big names, you know, whether it's Bain, McKinsey or BCG?
Yes, we tend to trick against each other. See? But like I said, competition is that tend to be healthy because it forces us to innovate. For example, like ourselves, we have also looked at new areas of growth amongst what we do. If you look at PwC 5 to 10 years ago, or the last 50 years, if I may say, we are a very traditional service organization. But now it's no longer the case. We are now branding ourselves as a service plus a product organization. So, for example, we not only focus in building up capabilities to service our clients, but also we are investing in building up a portfolio of digital assets to complement the services that we provide.
And what are those digital assets?
Well, it could be simple data tools to help you do financial reconciliation, or tools that to minimize cybersecurity risk, for example. So there are many tools that are relevant to the service that we provide, and we use it and we market it as a package to the clients.
Now, Sue, I want to talk about human capital. It's probably the most important resource at any accounting firm, right? So I think PwC has close to 250,000 staff globally. But I want to start at the very bottom. Let's talk about the auditors, you know, who toil for hours and according to JobStreet, earn 2,700 ringgit. Is that fair to them? And is there work-life balance, especially when there are deadlines to meet? And the reason why I'm asking this is because when I go to the PwC website, there's a lot of emphasis on this. So are truly workers given this work-life balance?
Work-life balance can be defined in many forms. Are we saying that 9 to 5? Or do you have enough time for personal time? And do you have enough downtime?
And are you paid too little for the work that you do, which is another part of this question?
So maybe I answer the first part first, right? Mm. The first part is in the profession and the nature of the work. And bear in mind, it's not just the accounting profession alone. You can compare that to, for example, the medical profession. Sometimes you have peak. Because of the nature of the business, you do have peak periods and a non-peak period. So sometimes you work very late, but you must be given ample time to rest. Some of our people can go for 1 month off, for example. Just after the peak, you go away for 1 month and rest. So this is how we have defined the type of work-life balance that we have. It's not about having a regular work hours of 9 to 5.
So that's
it's just not possible. It's just not possible. The nature of the work. Yeah, it's just not possible. Unless you're telling me that corporate Malaysia is prepared to move financial year end out from December. It's something that we have to manage. But we acknowledge that there will be time people will have to put in a lot of effort, much more than they should be. But in return, then we must give them ample time to rest when we have a downtime.
What about pay though? People always say auditors, especially junior auditors, are so underpaid for the work they do. And as a result, has it been hard to hire young talent? Have you seen this thing, brain drain, that we keep hearing about?
I would like to say that if I were to look at, even as we speak today, we don't have a problem in recruiting.
You do?
But no, we don't have a problem.
Okay, you don't.
We don't have a problem in recruiting. What we are struggling is to be able to retain the talent in Malaysia after a couple of years. Because the war for talent is a global phenomenon. And skilled accountants or skilled finance professionals are highly sought after around the world. That is the challenge that we have.
So, Suhu, are you seeing the great resignation that we talked about earlier now with the economy reopening?
Well, certainly I will say that the attrition rate has spiked up probably in the last 6 months or so. And we are not alone in this. I think it applies to most of the firms in the industry. But it's not insurmountable in that you can't recruit more to enough to replenish. I think we do have a strategy that is in place that to ensure that we are able to continue and sustain the business.
Maybe that hopefully that involves a pay raise for everybody and starting salaries go up. Maybe the junior auditors will be appreciated. Let's end this conversation about tax, which is one area of service that PwC offers. How critical is it for us to reform our taxation system in Malaysia?
Oh, that's a trick question. Yeah, so if you talk about the general picture, is that there are always many ways to increase revenue. And for a start, I do think that Malaysia need to expand the tax base as a starting point. I think it is the least controversial of any viewpoints as far as tax system is concerned, because we certainly as a country really desperate to widen the tax base, because we are just dependent on too few collecting points and too narrow a part of the society paying the taxes. GST is one way, but it's not the only way. There must be other ways that we can do. We can potentially look at taxes that drive positive value to society. I think one example is the sugar tax that we have spoken about in the past. That is an example. We can provide incentives for companies that interested in refurbish their building to be green.
Carbon tax.
Yeah, or carbon tax, for example. Then you will create what I call a double objective and yet make it less controversial, because anything that you want to increase tax tend to be a little bit controversial and political. So it's not so easy to just impose something and increase tax just like that. So the other aspect that I will say is that the processes in terms of collecting tax is in the right direction, but there are many ways that we still can improve. One of the things that are coming on board, which is a global trend, is about common reporting system. Having a common reporting standard to automatically exchange taxpayer information with 100 other participating jurisdictions that Malaysia has signed up for, probably is the way to go. Because what you want to make sure is that people pay tax as they should, and yet they are not penalized unfairly. An equitable tax collection process is a necessity.
Have we met that benchmark, though, in Malaysia?
I think we are heading the right direction, but obviously it takes some time to get everything up and running, because everything centers around data collection and also processes that is harmonized.
On that note, thank you for your time today. On The Breakfast Grill was Su Hu Kun Yen, Managing Partner of PwC Malaysia. I'm Wong Shaoning, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.